Thank you, Tony. Good evening, everybody. My name is Jack, and I am an alcoholic. And I come to you from Hagerstown, Maryland, where I am a member of the cleverly named Hagerstown Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We are the third oldest group in the state of Maryland. And back when our group was started, if you had one town, you had one meeting. That's just the way they did it. Now, as you know, a few resentments and a couple of coffee pots later, we got 15 groups and 50-some meetings. And that's how we grow in AA. Speaking of resentments, I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking to you folks over here, because you're going to be watching TV. I'm going to talk to you folks over here. You're my people. You're actually going to be looking at me. I want to thank Brenda. Actually, I want to thank the committee for allowing Brenda to call me to invite me to come here. I think it's very important that you know who is responsible for my being here. Because if I say anything that offends you during the next 2.5 hours that we're together, karaoke or no karaoke, you talk to Brenda. But if I happen to say something that you agree with, please, by all means, see me in the hospitality room. I could really use those attaboys. I'm going to put my watch up here, Tony. I really can't see it, and I don't pay any attention to it anyway, but I think it gives hope to the newcomers. Now, I heard Robert and his admonition about cell phones. If I'd have brought mine with me, I'd have turned it on. I don't like being told what to do. And I suspect you don't either. So if you got your cell phone with you, by all means, turn it on. Especially if you're anticipating a liver transplant, because we don't want you to miss out on that. But if you'd be so kind as to put that phone on vibrate, and that way you can enjoy your incoming call and you won't disturb the rest of us. All right? My mom is 95 years old. She was married to my alcoholic father for 30 years. I tell you that not because it has anything to do with my being an alcoholic, but usually when I come to these events, I go by and tell my mom where I'm going to be. And she's not doing real well right now, so we didn't have this conversation. But if she'd have been up to having the conversation, I know she would have said something like, "You're going to be talking to another one of those AA things, aren't you?" And yes, ma'am, I am. And she said, "You make sure that you tell those people that you are not an alcoholic." I'm thinking maybe I should start listening to my mom. She might be onto something. I may have overreacted to this whole thing. So we're going to see in the next 2.5 hours if we can figure out whether I'm actually supposed to be here or not. I used to say that drinking really didn't affect or interfere with my life when I began to drink. But now, as a result of good sponsorship, I have to report to you that I spent 5 years in high school. Now, I used to think it was a result of a lot of bad breaks and misunderstandings, but it turns out it was the drinking. I didn't know it at the time, but it was. I got out of high school, and I went to the local community college, and One summer, my good friend Bill and I had decided we were going to take a road trip. We're going to drive to California. We got 12 cases of beer, put them in the back of my car. We each packed an overnight bag. We had everything you needed for a trip to California. Didn't have a map. But the night before we left, Bill's dad told him he couldn't go. And I was crushed. I'd quit my job. Bill was a stand-up guy. He gave me his half interest in those 12 cases of beer. And as many of you know, the easternmost border of the state of Maryland is on the Atlantic Ocean. And we have a resort community there called Ocean City. And so I went to Ocean City, and I spent the month of August living as a bum. I stayed in the basement of hotels where I knew folks who had been, were working as desk clerks and bellhops. I knew some folks that were working in restaurants, and so I ate leftover restaurant food every night, uneaten crab cake, half a lobster tail. Had my 12 cases of beer. When I got finished drinking them, I don't share. But after the second week, I had to buy some, but I did have that pocket full of money. And I had a great month in Ocean City. I really enjoyed myself. In fact, I enjoyed myself so much that I determined that I wanted to work in Ocean City the following summer. But I am a keen observer of my surroundings. And it became apparent to me that it didn't matter if you were a lifeguard or a beach boy or a waiter or a waitress, a bellhop, a desk clerk. It did not matter if you drank like I drank and acted like I acted when drinking. Over the course of an entire summer, there was a very good chance of getting arrested. And I did not want to get arrested. But there were in Ocean City a group of people who drank like I drank. They acted like I acted, and they did not get arrested. And these were the members of the Ocean City Police Force. So I became a police officer. That first summer, they gave me a boardwalk beat, and within a matter of days, if not a week to 10 days, it became apparent that I have a talent. Unique talent that became in particularly handy. And that is, I can spot an underage drinker from 100 yards. And I would pick out my target of opportunity, and I would approach him or her, and we would establish that indeed they were underage. And then I would ask, what's in the cooler? And they'd say, well, I got some Coca-Cola in there and got a little Tupperware thing of tuna fish and a half loaf of bread. Would you mind opening the cooler? And they'd open the cooler. And there was the cans of Coke in a nice row and the crushed ice. Tupperware, tuna fish, half loaf of bread. But I would reach way down into the bottom of that cooler, and invariably, I'd come up with a Budweiser. And if you're that underage drinker, your life, as you understand it, is ended. Well, I know, you thought you were going to go to college, but you're not going to college. It ain't happening. You're going to jail. You're going to the Ocean City Jail. And no self-respecting college in this country is going to want you as a student when they find out that you've been in the Ocean City Jail. Now, maybe you were thinking about the military as a career, but that ain't happening. United States military doesn't need jailbirds like you. No, sir. You're going to go to that Ocean City Jail, and they're not going to have anything to do with you. What's that? Oh, I forgot to tell you, I'm calling your mom and dad back in Baltimore at 3 a.m., and I'm going to tell them you're locked up in the Ocean City Jail, and they got to come down and bail you out. You want to offer a compromise, an alternative. What might that be? Confiscate the beer. Well, that's certainly worthy of consideration. But you do understand that if I confiscate the beer, I'm going to take the cooler. And if I take the cooler, I'm taking the Coca-Cola and the tuna fish. You're okay with that? Okay, you're free to go. Now, it is very difficult to walk a boardwalk beat while dragging a cooler full of beer around behind you. So I had to work out an arrangement with my lieutenant and my sergeant, and they would come and collect the coolers as I accumulated them. And we would meet at the end of my shift, and if I'd gotten any whiskey or any wine, I'd give it to the lieutenant and sergeant. And I'd take the cooler and the beer and the Coca-Cola and the tuna fish back home. I had a great summer that summer. I drank every day. I didn't buy anything to drink the entire summer. And I didn't get arrested. And that's my idea of a good summer. Went back for a second summer. And that second summer, they gave me a squad car. Lights and sirens. My very own. It was one of those big old Ford Crown Victorias. You ever looked in the trunk of one of them things? You can get three bodies in there or five coolers. No problem. Really didn't need my lieutenant and sergeant, but they met me at the end of every shift, and I would give them the whiskey and the wine, and I took the coolers. And if you were a friend of mine and you were coming to Ocean City, actually, you didn't even have to be a friend of mine. You could be a friend of a friend of mine, and you came to Ocean City and you needed a cooler, I'm your guy. I mean, I got coolers up to the ceiling of my back porch. And I have a no-return policy, so you just come pick out the cooler you want, have a great time in Ocean City, just don't get arrested. I had a great summer that summer. Drank every day. Didn't buy anything to drink, and I didn't get arrested. So I went back for a third summer, and I got my squad car back. I'm going to tell you about an event that changed the entire course of my life. It was 3 o'clock in the morning. On the Ocean Highway, I'd stopped a car for drunk driving. I had the driver out of the car. He was obviously drunk. I'm writing him up, and he says to me, "You don't know who I am, do you, officer?" I said, "No, sir, I don't." He said, "I am the state's attorney for Worcester County, the county you're standing in right now." I'm a college kid. I mean, I'm at the University of Maryland College Park. I have no idea what I want to do with my life. I barely have a hint that I might graduate. My grade point average and my blood alcohol content are running neck and neck. I never heard of a state's attorney before. I'd never seen one before. I didn't have any idea what a state's attorney did. So I said, "Well, good for you. Sign the ticket." So he signed a ticket, and there was a fellow there who appeared to be sober, and so I let him drive the car, and they went on their way. And 8 o'clock, the shift ended. I pulled into the parking lot of the police department, and there was the chief of police. And he said, "Come up to my office and bring that ticket book with you." Now, these were the first words the chief had spoken to me all summer. I'm about to get recognition. Long overdue recognition, I might add, for a job well done. So I went up to the chief's office, and when I walked into his office, much to my surprise, seated on the couch right inside the door, is the guy I gave the ticket to at 3 o'clock in the morning. Chief says, "Give me that ticket book." I hand him the ticket book. He flipped it open to the ticket. He hands it to the guy on the couch. The guy on the couch takes out a pen, and he writes across the face of that ticket, "Case dismissed." and signs his name. It was at that moment I decided that I wanted to be a lawyer. And if I could be one of them state's attorneys, I definitely want to be one of them. But if you drank and drove like I drank and drove, the ability to dismiss traffic tickets with a stroke of a pen would come in mighty handy. So I went to law school. My wife and I had met at the University of Maryland. We got married while I was in law school and got out of law school. We went back to my hometown of Hagerstown. I began to practice law. Within 6 or 8 weeks, I became aware that the state's attorney in Hagerstown was looking for an assistant state's attorney. So I went right over. I mean, here I am, answer to your prayers. When would you like me to start? Now, what I'm about to tell you is what I think I heard him say. You may have experienced this in your own life. I don't know. But it turns out many things that I had thought I'd heard said had never been said. And a lot of stuff I thought I saw happen never really happened. I have a perception problem, and I have a hearing deficiency. But this is what I thought I heard him say. What? Are you some kind of idiot? You just got out of law school. You've never been to court. You've never impaneled a jury. You've never examined or cross-examined a witness. You've never made an opening statement or a closing argument. We don't have any time to train you. Get out of the office. That's what I thought I heard him say. In reality, I believe they said something to the effect that the job has been filled. But I heard what I heard, and I know it's going to surprise some of you, but I'm a very sensitive person, and I don't suffer well, and I was hurt, wounded. I now know that I left there with a resentment, and you know that an alcoholic with a resentment can do quite a bit, and I'm Maryland, probably just like here in Georgia, we elect our state's attorneys. So I went out and found a lawyer who wanted to be state's attorney. I ran his campaign for state's attorney. He got elected state's attorney. He made me deputy state's attorney. You get to be deputy state's attorney, they give you a badge. And when they give you a badge, they give you a badge case. And in that badge case, there's a clear glassine window, and you put your driver's license behind that window. And when they pull you over and they say, let me see your license and registration, you show them the badge case. They don't look at the license. They look at the badge. Oh, the badge officer? Deputy State's Attorney, Washington County. No, sir, I am not upset that you stopped me. No, sir. I fully understand you're doing your job. I might have had 4 or 5, maybe as many as 6. Yes, sir. Yeah. Only got a couple miles to go. Right. I think I can stay on my side of the road. Yes, sir. Yeah. Well, I really appreciate the professional courtesy that you're extending to me, officer. And yes, sir. You have a nice night, too. Yes, nice talking to you, sir. Now, some of you are getting a little insight into why I've never been arrested or had an alcohol-related offense, but it gets better. My boss, the state's attorney, was going to be appointed circuit court judge. And if he got appointed circuit court judge, I was going to become state's attorney. But as sometimes happens, I don't know about here in Georgia, but up in Maryland, local state senator sticks his nose in where it doesn't belong, screws the whole thing up. Somebody else got appointed circuit court judge. And I was disappointed for my friend. But I was some kind of upset that I didn't get to be state's attorney. I may not be much, but I'm all I think about. And One night, while having some adult beverages with some like-minded individuals, it was determined that something needed to be done about that state senator. Needed to teach him a lesson. Somebody had to volunteer to run against him at the next election, defeat him. So I ran for the state senate. Now, I did not know that the state senator was going to run off with the secretary from the Appropriations Committee, abandon his wife and three children, and move to Florida. But he did. And I got elected state senator. Now, in Maryland, when you get elected state senator, they give you a license plate. And it says, State Senator. Now, this license plate is an aid to efficient law enforcement. Because when they come up behind you on the interstate, and they got those overheads going on, and they get close enough to see that license plate, they turn those overheads off. And they come up alongside of you, they turn that interior dome light on, and they toot. Beep, beep. Hi, Senator. Hi, Trooper. Hold it down, Senator. Okay, Trooper. And that way, you don't have members of the Maryland State Police tied up alongside of the highway with members of the General Assembly when they could be out arresting real crooks. And now, I'm the state senator, and that guy that got appointed as circuit court judge, he didn't like his job. So he quit. I went to see the governor. Governor, I'd like you to appoint my friend, the state's attorney. I'd like you to appoint him circuit court judge. Governor said, can't do that. Too much adverse publicity surrounding that last judicial appointment in Hagerstown. So I will not, cannot appoint your friend. However, if you'd like to be circuit court judge, I'll appoint you. Well, in Maryland, it's a 15-year term. We only had two in Hagerstown. So I became circuit court judge. Scary, isn't it? I'm drinking alcoholically all through this. I mean, I love to drink. I love drinking. I love everything about drinking. I was a barroom drinker. I was a man of the people. I love neon lights. I love the way the light reflects into the back bar mirror and then reflects through the different shaped bottles and the different colors of the liquids contained in the bottles, the greens and the yellows and the tans and the browns, the clears. Loved it. Love the peanut shells on the floor. Love the sawdust. Love the smell of stale beer and urine. I mean, I love everything about drinking. I like the ambiance of drinking. I mean, right now, July, all those frosty, long, slender Tom Collins glasses that got put away during the winter, they're out now. You know, I like the little short, stubby, old-fashioned glasses. I do like the stemware. I like the fluted glass of the gin martini. I mean, where can you get olives like that? Although it is, I had a really bad gin experience, and to this day, it's hard for me to go into a pine forest. My beverage of choice was Jack Daniel's Black Label on crushed ice with a twist of lemon. That was wonderful. But if you came up to me and you shoved a brown paper bag at me and you said, "Here, Judge, take a pull on this," I would not ask you what was in that bag. Because you wouldn't have offered it to me if it wasn't good. You know, sometimes you have folks over to watch a ball game or play cards or whatever, and you know, people have been having some beers and they leave and there's cans all around. You got to pick them up and, you know, ooh, this one's got a little something in it. And oh man, what was that? Cigarette butt, you got it. Right here in the second row. Yeah, I knew there were cigarette butt drinkers in here and we got started. It's not necessary that you raise your hands, I know. It's just enough that I know you're here. Thank you. I didn't know that on April the 7th, 1982, when a local attorney and I had determined that he and I had decided we were going to go out and get drunk. We told my wife that we were going out to have dinner. But he and I had determined that we were going out. This was not one of those occasions where I was being negligently overserved. The purpose of the evening was to get knee-walking, snot-flying drunk. And we did. And we ended up in a local honky-tonk. And it is embarrassing to have to stand here and share with you what I am compelled to tell you. Believe me, if I'd have had any idea whatsoever that this was going to be my last drink of beverage alcohol, I would have ordered something else. I mean, it's shameful what I have to tell you. If somebody had even hinted that I'd have to come to the 35th annual Atlanta Roundup and tell you folks what I am compelled to tell you, I definitely would have ordered something else. My last drink of beverage alcohol was Tia Maria. How do you think I feel? I can tell from the expression on some of your faces that you have no idea what Tia Maria is. Well, let me assure you, you do not need to know. I mean, if you're here attending this convention and you're harboring a thought about maybe going out there one more time, for God's sake, don't do it for Tia Maria, because it's going to be a bad deal. It'll be a bad deal if you go at all. I mean, here we're safe, so stay. I mean, if you're here, why not stay here? I mean, what the heck? Nothing here designed to harm anybody, only designed to give us a life worth living. So if you're here, stay here. But if you go for Tia Maria, don't call me up and complain about it. Talk to Brenda. Now, my wife, who was introduced to you earlier, up until the end of June, has been a school teacher. And she taught elementary school. And my guess is that the elementary school children here in Georgia are just like the elementary school children in Hagerstown, Maryland. They are just germ encrusted. And the germs jump off them little kids onto their school teacher. And then the school teacher comes home, and the germs jump onto the spouse of the school teacher. And the next morning, I got up, I had flu. Flu. But we go to work. We are not missing work for a little case of the flu. Because if you miss work, somebody might say that my drinking was interfering with my work. And I'm not giving you that opportunity. So I go to work, tried a case that day, went home that night, had flu. Next day was Good Friday. Didn't have to go to work. Got an upset stomach. Frequently accompanies flu. Saturday, still got flu. I got upset stomach, but now I am developing lower tract distress. And if you've got that upset stomach thing going on, combined with that lower tract distress thing, that will hone your decision making down to a really fine edge. And I didn't know whether to sit or kneel or kneel or sit. And on at least one occasion that weekend, I made the wrong decision. And if you want to, you can talk to my wife about that later. I'm moving on. Easter Sunday, got flu. Monday after Easter, I am bad dehydrated from all that sitting and kneeling that I've been doing over the weekend. So they put me in the hospital. My abdomen became distended. They did an emergency laparotomy on me, opened me up. They found my abdomen full of gangrene, peritonitis. While they were trying to clean that up, my kidneys quit. My liver was enlarged and out of whack. My pancreas was digesting itself. And my respiratory system quit. And things weren't looking good for the home team. And I spent 3 weeks in intensive care in the Hagerstown Hospital. And my condition deteriorated. Now, they got me off the respirator, and they got my abdomen cleaned up, but my kidneys wouldn't work, my liver was out of whack, and my pancreas was still digesting itself. So they came to my wife, and they told her that they were going to send me down to Johns Hopkins. Now, they also told her they were sending me down there to die. They did not expect me to come back. They didn't think there was anything that could be done for me, but if anybody could do anything, maybe Hopkins could. Now, they didn't tell me that. I would have found that discouraging. I knew people had gone to Johns Hopkins, and they'd lived. And I knew people had gone to the Washington County Hospital, and they'd died. So I thought this was a pretty good deal going down to Johns Hopkins. So I went down there, and for 2 weeks, they did everything but hang me by my thumbs. And, man, I couldn't take it anymore. I couldn't take it. My belly button birthday is on May the 14th, and on the night of May the 13th, these learned doctors came to my room, and before they could get anything out of their mouth, I told them, I said, I can't take it anymore. I need a day of rest. They said, that's why we're here. We don't know what else to do in your situation, and we're not going to do anything tomorrow, so you get a day of rest. And I turned 40 in the Johns Hopkins Hospital. 2 weeks later, on May 28th, I was discharged from that hospital. My kidney function returned, my liver was back within normal range, don't know if there was any permanent damage or not at the time, and my pancreas has stopped digesting myself. And when you're in the hospital for 7 weeks like that, they like to talk to you before you go home. Want to have a little chat about the do's and don'ts. But if you got an undiagnosed illness, they really don't know what to tell you. In my case, they said, Judge, we just suggest you don't get it again, because if you do, it's likely to kill you. And I was almost out of that doctor's office when one of the doctors said, could we ask you one more question, Judge? And I said, sure, what's that? They said, do you drink? I'm a lawyer. Well, I used to be a lawyer. When I was a lawyer, I had to drink with clients. I had to drink with other lawyers. I had to drink with judges. Now that I'm a judge, I got to drink with lawyers. I got to drink with other judges. It's a matter of professional responsibility, of course. Why do you ask? Well, you know, you got your liver and your pancreas and your kidneys involved, and nothing destroys those three delicate organs like alcohol. And we just don't know what would happen to you if you took a drink, so we would like you to not drink for a while. How long? A year. Ooh, yeah, in a year. Man. Well, let's see. I had my last drink on April the 7th. This is May 28th. I can probably do that. They said, no, Judge, you don't understand. This is Memorial Day weekend. And we want you to not drink for 1 year from June the 1st. Now, I know that there are people in this audience here tonight who have already discerned the injustice that these physicians were trying to foist upon me. I was getting no credit for my 7 weeks of continuous sobriety. And I want you to know that an argument broke out between those two learned physicians and this knuckleheaded judge as to when I would be able to next drink. And we reached a compromise. And the compromise was that I would not drink until next April the 7th. And then if I thought any of the pain, suffering, and misery that I had just endured was in any way associated with what I had just gone through, that I would not drink until the 1st of June. And so I walked out of the Johns Hopkins Hospital into the most insane period of my life. Not drinking and not changing. Now, nobody said anything about alcoholism. Not drinking and not changing. It's kind of like not drinking and going to meetings. And I hope you folks here in Georgia don't tell newcomers, don't drink and go to meetings. Because don't drink and go to meetings kills people. Because they believe us. Our book says and our experience confirms that for the alcoholic, you take alcohol away from me, I become restless, irritable, and discontented. Well, let me tell you, that is a gross understatement in my case. And the choice then becomes, do I pick up a drink, not drinking and not changing, slow suicide, or do I pick up a gun, or drive into a bridge abutment, or go out a window, fast suicide. Now, in my case, knowing that I couldn't drink and not wishing to experience that pain and suffering that I had experienced, I figured I'd just shoot myself. Our sheriff had shot himself in the basement of our courthouse. My office was on the top floor of the courthouse, and I thought if I just shot myself in my office, it would add symmetry to the building. You really think that's funny? Who's your sponsor? Now, my alcoholic father, the one my mom was married to for 30 years, on July the 3rd, 1968, was going past a church, and out on the message board it said, "Don't buy a fifth on the third for the fourth." My dad saw that. He went to Alcoholics Anonymous. He never drank again. When he died with 15 years of continuous sobriety in this wonderful program. I carry his 15-year chip along with my chip. And I hope that in some small way, I can repay something on the great debt that I owe to Alcoholics Anonymous for my father's life. My dad lost everything. He lost that marriage to my mom. He lost the respect of his children, my sister who's younger than I am, and myself. When she got married, he was not invited to the wedding. I gave her away. I walked her down the aisle. She didn't want him to come because she thought he would come drunk. He came anyway. He was drunk. He lost a business he spent 25 years building from scratch. We lost our home. He lost his self-respect. He lost his self-esteem. He lost all the material stuff and all the priceless stuff. And then he came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And Alcoholics Anonymous gave him back the priceless stuff. He got his integrity back. He got his self-esteem back. He became the person that God had always intended for him to be. And I owe a tremendous debt to Alcoholics Anonymous for my father's life. There are two guys in Hagerstown, Bob and Ken, staunch members of Alcoholics Anonymous, who knew my dad and knew that he had died with 15 years of sobriety. And they're watching me die of untreated alcoholism, not drinking and not changing. Now, I think everybody knows that alcoholics drink. Everybody knows that. So with every passing day, of every passing week, of every passing month, of every passing year, it was proof positive that I am not alcoholic. Now, I'll admit, I might be a little bit on edge, okay? I might be a little bit prickly, okay? But you know what the real problem is? The real problem is you guys are not doing what I'm telling you to do. If you do what I tell you to do, you and I are going to get along great. But you mess around with me, you keep screwing with me, I'll tell you what's going to happen. I am fine, okay? I'm fine. There's nothing wrong with me. Just do what I told you. Fine. Brenda, how would you like to have your DWI in front of me on Monday morning, huh? Yeah. That'd be your worst nightmare. Yeah. Fine. Things are fine. Bob and Ken came to me, and Bob said, Jack, we have this book, Alcoholics Anonymous. We call it the Big Book. Wondering if you'd be interested in reading it to find out about your dad's illness. Clever guy, that, Bob. Because we've already established there's nothing wrong with me. If they'd have said, you ought to read this book, find out what's wrong with you, I'm not reading the book. But I was interested in finding out about my dad's illness. And so I read that book. And no surprise to me, my dad's in there. I mean, my dad was a real alcoholic as described in the Big Book, Alcoholics Anonymous. No surprise there. But what did come as a surprise was I'm in there. And I hadn't counted on that. I think Ken and Bob had counted on it. But it came as a big surprise to me. I mean, that book was written before I was born. And it contains descriptions of experiences that I have had in my life. And they wrote about those experiences before they happened. How could they know? How could they describe something in such intimate detail before it ever happened? So I went back to Ken and Bob, and I told them that I was willing to concede that there was a possibility. A remote possibility, but a possibility nonetheless, that I may have contracted a very mild case of alcoholism. We caught it just in time. Well, that was all Ken and Bob needed. They came to my judge's chambers every Friday at noon. As my judge's office, and they brought their big books and a brown bag lunch. And I had a lunch and my big book. We would eat our lunch. We would pray the Serenity Prayer. We would read from the big book. And then Ken and Bob would explain to me the importance of what we had read. And then I would explain to them as Jack sees it. And as I am sure you might suspect, we had many high-level intellectual discussions about the content and meaning of the big book. And I explained to Ken and to Bob, as I think I should point out to you, that while it is true that I spent 5 years in high school, I think it's important that you know that I received an associate's degree from the community college in 2 years. Went down to University of Maryland College Park in 2 more years. Got a bachelor's degree. Went over to the University of Maryland School of Law, where in 3 years they awarded me a Juris Doctorate degree with honors, I might add. And Ken said, "Jack, we've got degrees on rectal thermometers, and you know what we do with them." He said that in my office. I thought that was a little harsh. I had never heard that before. I've heard it quite a bit in Alcoholics Anonymous since I've been here, but I'd never heard it before that occasion. And you see, Ken and Bob, they were willing to risk offending me, because they knew that I'd been offended before, and I'd get over it. And they were willing to risk angering me, because they knew that I'd been angry before, and I'd get over that. But they're watching me die of untreated alcoholism, and they know if something doesn't happen, if change doesn't take place soon, then I'm a goner. They knew that. I didn't know that. I didn't know that they knew that. I know if I'd have known that they knew something that I didn't know, the mere fact that I knew that they knew something that I didn't know would make me angry. And they knew it would make me angry not knowing what it was that they knew that I didn't know that they knew that I didn't know. But they also knew that if they were persistent and consistent in giving this program to me, that there would come a time that I actually would know what it was that they knew that I didn't know. And by that time, I wouldn't be angry knowing that they knew something that I didn't know, because then I would know what it was that they knew that I didn't know. And knowing, I mean, in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know when you know that you know, and not a moment before. You all right, Carol? All right. Aren't you glad? Now, if you followed that, you're in the right place. And if you're here tonight and you find that to have been the least bit confusing, you're still in the right place. Just means you don't know. December 22nd, 1989 was the Friday before Christmas. The courthouse was closed. We could not have our big book meeting together. So Ken and Bob and I went out to lunch. Now, let me say parenthetically that when I was drinking, my wife and I were separated on 3 separate occasions, and there were women involved. And after I stopped drinking, my wife and I were separated on 3 separate occasions, and there were women involved. She didn't laugh. Now, I think it's pretty clear that drinking had nothing to do with any of those 6 separations. But alcoholism had everything to do with all 6 of those separations, and we had no idea. And on this day, December the 22nd, 1989, we were separated. And I had an apartment. And I had a girlfriend. And I had a backup girlfriend, just in case my girlfriend found out who I really was. And then I had a girlfriend for special occasions. And not surprisingly, my wife objected to my girlfriends. And my girlfriends objected to my wife. And I told Ken and Bob that I was managing this all quite well. And if you're looking for a delusional thought, there's one for you. We had our lunch. I went back to my apartment. The mailman had propped a Hickory Farms package against my door. One of those things you only see at Christmas time when they send you a cheese log or a sausage. And I thought that was nice. And took it into my apartment and taking some messages off my answering machine because, you see, I had plans for that evening. I had plans for the following day, had plans for Christmas Eve, had plans for Christmas Day, had plans for New Year's, had plans well into the following year. And so I'm listening to the answering machine, and I see where the package is sealed with some scotch tape, and I got out my car keys, and I cut the tape holding that box together with the car keys, and I'm listening to the answering machine, and I lift the lid of that box, boom! And I got blown back against the wall. And about 10 days before that, a federal appellate judge had been killed in Birmingham, Alabama, by a package bomb had been sent to his home. And here in Savannah, Georgia, a lawyer had been killed by a package bomb sent to his office about 5 days before. I think, upon reflection, the day before, they found a package bomb in the Atlanta courthouse that had been delivered by the post office. And I could smell the gunpowder, and I knew I'd opened a bomb. And there was a fire, and I couldn't put it out, and I went out in the hallway and pulled the fire alarm. My neighbor came, said he had a fire extinguisher. I went back into a telephone. It wasn't in the area where the fire was, and I went to push the button for 911, and at that point I realized that part of my right hand had been blown away. And they said police, fire, or rescue, and I said I'd like to have one of each. And finished that phone call and felt like somebody was pulling my trousers off my hips. And I looked down on the floor and I was standing in a puddle of blood and it was getting bigger and bigger and bigger as I looked at it. And I knew I was in serious trouble. And my neighbor came and asked if there was anything else he could do and asked him to get me a towel. And he did. And I opened my trousers and I did not have the courage to attempt to visualize the wound. I put the towel where I thought I'd been injured. I put my back against the wall and I slid down onto the floor and it was clear to me that I was going to die on that floor. And I could feel life draining away. And I was alone. I was terribly frightened. And I was absolutely powerless. And I didn't know what to do. I didn't know if I was going to die on that floor and never see my wife and our three children again. I just didn't know. I remembered that all those times that Ken and Bob and I were together on Friday afternoons, that we always began our time together with a serenity prayer. And that's the only thing I had. And so I asked God to grant me the serenity to accept this thing which I could not change. To give me the courage to change what I could and the wisdom to know the difference. And I prayed that prayer. 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 And I can't tell you whether it was the fourth, fifth, or sixth time through that prayer. But what I can tell you is that God came. God came. And I was overwhelmed by a sense of peace and well-being, the likes of which I had never experienced before in my life, nor have I experienced it since. And I knew that if I died on that floor that afternoon, never saw my wife, and never saw our three children again, it'd be okay. be okay. And the police, fire, and rescue people burst through the door of my apartment, and both my eardrums had been blown out, and we were having some difficulty communicating. And as soon as I stopped the serenity prayer, a tremendous wave of fear swept upon me. And so I told those guys, I said, you do what you have to do, and I'm going back to what I was doing. And as soon as I went back to the serenity prayer, that sense of peace and well-being returned. And they cut all my clothes off of me, with the exception of my red and green Christmas socks. They strapped me on a board and put me on a gurney and carried me down three flights of steps. And our local television station was Johnny on the Spot, and they stuffed me into an ambulance, and they got a picture of my red and green Christmas socks sticking out the end of that ambulance. My socks went around the world on CNN, and I went to surgery. And they couldn't find my wife, and they couldn't find my girlfriend, but they found my sponsor, Ken. And they let him come back to where I was being prepared for surgery. And Ken held my hand, and he prayed for me, and we prayed together. They took me up to surgery, and I don't know how shrapnel knows how to stop when passing through flesh, but I can tell you what they told me, and that is they removed a rather significant piece of shrapnel, not resting against, but in close proximity to my femoral artery. And had my femoral artery been nicked, there'd be a different speaker here tonight for sure. And they took me up to a recovery room, and when I came to, seated at the foot of my bed was my sponsor, Bob. And let me say here, it's good to have a sponsor. It is really good to have a sponsor. If you're new here tonight and you don't have a sponsor, I mean, there are hundreds of people who are here who are eminently qualified to be your sponsor. We're not asking you to get married. We're asking you to get a sponsor. Somebody who's been down the path ahead of us, who knows the tiger traps. Maybe you've been here a while. Maybe you and your sponsor have grown apart. Maybe your sponsor's moved away. Maybe your sponsor's passed on. Maybe you're doing that ism of alcoholism, the old I sponsor myself deal. If you're here tonight and you're sponsoring yourself, I don't mean to be rude, and I certainly don't mean to be unkind, but you got an idiot for a sponsor. You need to get a sponsor. Sponsors see things differently. They have a different take on things. When I'm laying in that bed and I see Bob, and Bob's smiling. I said, Bob, I see you smiling. What are you smiling about? Oh, he says, Jack, I think it must be wonderful to know that you can't be harmed. I said, harm, Bob? Somebody just tried to kill me. He said, oh, I know, Jack. He said, I understand that package that you opened contained four pipe bombs. He says, one pipe bomb is more than adequate to kill a human being. Two pipe bombs is a little redundant. Three pipe bombs, that's around a bend. Four pipe bombs, Jack, you have made somebody very angry. He said, man has done his very best to try to kill you. And the only explanation of your survival is the grace of God. Good to have a sponsor. I wouldn't have come up with that in a million years. He said, God has spared you for a purpose, Jack. I said, really, Bob? What might that be? Oh, he said, Jack, I wouldn't be so presumptive as to hazard a guess as to what God's will for you is in that regard. But I do know this. I know that it's God's will for you to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that means you're going to have to pray that third step prayer with either Ken or myself. You're going to have to do that fourth step inventory. You're going to have to do that fifth step with me or with Ken. You're going to have to make that sixth step decision, pray that seventh step prayer. Make that eighth step list. Begin making those ninth step amends so you can live in 10 and 11 and 12 and become a maximum service to God and to your fellow man. Good to have a sponsor. I wouldn't have come up with that either. So, got out of the hospital on Christmas Day, 1989. Best Christmas I'd ever had up to that point. Christmas of 1990, my wife and I reconciled. We've been together ever since. If I don't screw this thing up, come next month, we'll be married 44 years. You're probably going to want to give her a chip for that. She's been married the entire 44 years. I've had time off for bad behavior, as you've already heard. So I got out of that hospital, and I got this thing, you know, I'm angry at God. And Bob says, how could you possibly be angry at God, all that's happened, all that God's done for you? I said, I'll tell you. When I was 14 years old, I prayed to my dad to stop drinking. He and I had a discussion. He agreed to stop drinking. And my mom and sister came home. I told them our problems had been solved. Dad was not going to drink again. Joy reigned supreme in our house. Clearly, it was the product of prayer. Mom had been praying. I'd been praying. My sister had been praying. Next day, Dad got drunk. I closed the door on God. I didn't want anything to do with a God that would play fast and loose with prayers, our family. Obviously, I was not worthy. My prayers were certainly not worthy. I determined if I was going to accomplish anything or be anything in this life, I was going to have to do it myself. And I began to worship at the altar of self-sufficiency. And Bob said, how old were you when your dad stopped drinking? So I was 26. He says, you were 14 when you prayed the prayer, 26 when he granted your prayer, 12 years. He says, Jack, he says, you got any idea what 12 years means to infinite God? Good to have a sponsor. This had not come up. No, Bob, I don't. He said, Jack, 12 years to infinite God is a nanosecond. It's an infinitesimal period of time. He said, in point of fact, you got pretty quick service. I don't know what your complaint is. Good to have a sponsor. So I embarked on this journey, this adventure in sober living. You know, in our book it says that drinking is really not my problem. Drinking is a symptom of my problem. The problem for the alcoholic centers in the mind. I don't know what you guys do in your mind. But all I do in my mind is think. Think, 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 think. Think, 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 think. I'm really glad I don't have a speaker on my forehead so that you would be hearing what I've been thinking just so since I've been up here. Think, 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 think. Simply how I think is my problem. S-H-I-T. Simply how I think is my problem. I know the delegate is here, and the folks up at GSO are always looking for recommendations. So I have written to GSO with a recommendation for an amendment to a pamphlet that many of you are familiar with. And if you find that any of these suggestions have merit, by all means, please talk to your delegate about that. But the pamphlet is called, is AA for You. And I have made the following suggestions. Have you ever decided to stop thinking for a week or so and only lasted for a couple of days? Do you wish people would mind their own business about your thinking and stop telling you what to do? Do you envy people who can think without getting into trouble? Have you had problems connected with your thinking during the past year? Has your thinking caused trouble at home? Do you tell yourself that you can stop thinking anytime you want to, even though you keep thinking when you don't mean to? Have you missed days of work or school because of your thinking? Have you ever felt that your life would be better if you did not think? Big book, it says that if I take certain actions, I will get certain results. And it says in the 10th step that sanity will have returned. And it says in the 2nd step that I came to believe that a power greater than myself would restore me to sanity. And so what happened between step 2 and step 10? 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. It also says that we have solutions for other difficulties. They're listed as the bedevilments. Problems with personal relationships. That would be my girlfriends and my wife and our separations. Couldn't control my emotional nature. I was like pissed off in the spring-loaded position is what I was. Prey to misery and depression. Couldn't make a living. Now here, they pay judges good money in Maryland. And my sponsor had to point out to me, Jack, anytime you spend more money than you're making, you're having trouble making a living. Okay. Full of fear. Well, now, wait a minute here. I already told you I've been a police officer, state senator, circuit court judge. I would say I have this feeling of impending doom. And Ken would say, you know what that is, Jack? And no. He says, that's impending doom. You're relying on Jack. A fear of the unknown. Fear of failure. Fear of success. Fear of commitment. You want to do something interesting when you go back to your home group? Slip up behind somebody. Whisper in their ear. They know. And walk away. Fear of being found out. The objective of Alcoholics Anonymous is to teach me to live a transparent life. Now you come up behind me and say, they know, but there's nothing to know. I'm not doing stuff I'm not supposed to be doing. Not anymore. I'm trying to suit up and show up and be a representative of God's will in my life and the very best alcoholic that I can be. That's my purpose in being. In the 8th step it says, I am to fit myself to be of maximum service to God and to my fellow man. I didn't sign up for that. It's just what God's destiny is for alcoholics. We just celebrated our 75th birthday in San Antonio. We're going to celebrate our 80th right here in 5 years. In all of recorded history, up until 75 years ago, there was no hope for me or for you. And here we are on a Friday night, all gathered up together, fully clothed, and in our right minds, not drinking. All because of a gracious, merciful God who has divinely inspired these two men, Dr. Bob, and I don't know where you moved Bill to, but he's over there. Oh, okay, Bill. I mean, if you read any, these guys would not be discouraged. Bill's in the lobby of the Mayflower Hotel. Telephone call, no. I don't know about you. I don't have a lot of staying power. You say no to me, the hell with it. I'm going into that bar. No. Of course you are. Come out to the house, Bill. Can you imagine a woman separated from her husband, living with two children, inviting a rummy from New York to come out to her house? I mean, what a disgrace if it were found out. But she was expectant that God would send somebody to help Dr. Bob. And here we are. Here we are. Well, in our book it says that if you do these things, Jack, great events will come to pass for you and countless others. Here's a great event that came to pass for me just recently. Ann and I have three children. They're all adults. They're all self-supporting through their own contributions. Yes! Our second oldest child, our oldest boy, 2 years ago, he and his wife had a baby. We had a granddaughter who's a little over 2.5 years old now. This past February, February the 5th, he and his wife had a little boy. And Ann and I went to the hospital for the birth of that child. And I went back to where the baby was with his mother. And I said, "What have you named your son?" And they said, "Jack." And our book says, the power of God goes deep. And there's been tremendous healing among our children as a result of the principles of the program of recovery of Alcoholics Anonymous and the power of a loving and gracious God. That's the most recent big event that's happened. But there's all kinds of little events. I mean, this is the only group of people that I'm aware of that ranks our miracles. That was a big miracle. Yeah, it was kind of a miracle. It was a little miracle. I had this God shot, you know what I mean? The age of miracles is right here. It's among us. We take our sobriety for granted, a lot of us, sometimes. The fact that I am standing here not drinking on a Friday night is miraculous. And I act sometimes like it's a normal, regular type of thing. And it's not. Dying chained to walls or under bridges, that's a normal thing for the alcoholic. People out there right now tonight are going to die of alcoholism. We are so blessed. Got another pamphlet with me called Members Eye of You. Hope you all read it. The longer I'm in AA, the less I know. But here's something that I do know for sure. I'm here as a result of prayer. And if you're here and you're alcoholic, you're here as a result of prayer. Now, you may not believe that, you may not like that, and quite frankly, I don't care. Because that's just the way it is with the truth. The truth is the truth, and that's the truth. Mom prayed. She didn't think I was alcoholic. She just thought I was crazy. "Please, God, send somebody to help my son, Jack." My wife prayed. Our children prayed. your mom or your dad prayed, your husband, your wife prayed, your children prayed, your boss, your neighbor, your friend prayed, lots of people prayed. You can get here on a winning streak. Somebody prayed. Now here's something I think we can all get our arms around without any argument, and that is that the people who are in this room at this very moment have never been assembled together before in the history of the world, and we are never, ever going to be assembled together again. And our book says there is one that has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Right here. Right now. That's where God is. God is in the moment. In this member's eye view, at the very end of it, the author says that on Sunday in the churches of many of us, so we'd be read that portion of the Gospel of Matthew, which recounts the time when John the Baptist was languishing in the prison of Herod. In hearing of the works of his cousin Jesus, he sent two of his disciples to say to him, Art thou he who is to come, or shall we look for another? And Christ did as he so often did. He did not answer them directly, but wanted John to decide for himself. And so he said to the disciples, Go and report to John what you have heard and what you have seen. The blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead rise. The poor have the gospel preached to them. Back in my childhood catechism days, I was taught that the poor in this instance meant not only the poor in a material sense, but also meant the poor in spirit, those who burned with an inner hunger and an inner thirst, and that the word gospel meant quite literally the good news. A number of years ago, two men working singularly and together, Ken and Bob, maneuvered me into Alcoholics Anonymous. If they were here, I would tell them what I tell you about what I found. It seems the blind do see, the lame do walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead rise, and over again in the middle of the longest day or the darkest night, the poor in spirit have the good news told to them. God grant that it may always be so. My name is Jack. I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is April the 7th, 1982. And as our friend Ed was so fond of saying, I love each and every one of you, and there's nothing you can do about it. Thanks for letting me share.